from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, the EPA released new guidelines on coal-burning power plants, the first ever national standard set in place for mercury and other poisons emitted into the air. Here is EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson.
Under the Clean Air Act, these standards will require American power plants to put in place proven and widely available pollution control technologies to cut harmful emissions of mercury, arsenic, chromium, nickel, and acid gases.
The coal-burning plants will have 3 years to comply with the new national standards, which are set to prevent 91% of mercury in coal from being released into the air. Environmental groups are hailing the new standards, and, of course, industries oppose. We'll debate the issue next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. For the first time, the EPA has placed national limits on mercury, a neurotoxin, and other toxic emissions from power plants. Power plants account nationally for about half of mercury emissions and over 70% of acid gases. The regulations mainly focus on coal-fired burners, about 1,100 presently in use at 600 power plants nationwide. And according to EPA head Lisa Jackson, about 40% of the nation's coal-fired power plants have no controls or technology presently in place. The Obama administration is claiming the new standards as a major environmental and public health victory. The EPA estimates the new rules will prevent some 4,700 heart attacks a year and 130,000 cases of childhood asthma symptoms. There will be, however, billions of dollars in costs for the utilities to comply, and those costs will no doubt be passed on to households. And in this Forum Hour, we take up the issue. Joining us first is Ryan Tracy. He's energy and environmental policy reporter with The Wall Street Journal, and he's with us from Washington, D.C. And welcome, Ryan Tracy. Good to have you aboard.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. This took 20 years, and it is being claimed, as I said, as a major victory, environmental victory, by the Obama administration. In fact, I noticed Paul Krugman said it's on a par with getting lead out of gasoline. Is it that big, really?
Yeah, this is a very big deal. You'll hear some of the environmental groups claim that it's the biggest sort of air quality progress that we'll see in a generation, and they may well be right about that, given the extent to which coal power plants contribute to air pollution. Another indication of how big a deal it is for the Obama folks is the way that they rolled it out, rather than releasing it late in the day on a Friday, as they're wont to do sometimes with these EPA regulations, particularly when they've done something that they don't think the environmental community will be pleased with. This time, they called a big press conference at Children's Hospital in Washington yesterday, made sure there was video from the president and Lisa Jackson readily available. So this is something that they're very proud of and something that they can put as a feather in their cap when they're trying to court green-minded voters.
It is going to cost, though. Some estimates almost as high as $11 billion, and that will go to households. These costs are for scrubbers mainly, the control equipment that essentially the EPA says will far be offset by health benefits?
That's right. Yeah, it's going to be about $9.6 billion, actually, over the first few years to install this pollution control equipment at the plants. And this is very expensive to install, so a lot of the companies will have to make the decision of whether they want to close down the plant or keep it open. I talked to Constellation Energy, which owns a plant in Maryland on which they've already installed a full suite of pollution control equipment, and it's a big plant, but it cost them about $885 million to do it there. So this is not cheap. It's not cheap to run a power plant in general, and these companies have big capital plans, and so they'll have to make the determination, do they want to retrofit the plant, or do they want to shut it down and build something that uses natural gas to make electricity? Or, you know, these are good decisions that are going to be made going forward.
Decisions moving ahead. What about with respect to jobs? How do you read that as a reporter? Both sides are saying, on the one hand, we're hearing that all kinds of jobs are going to be lost, and we'll hear that probably from a representative from industry. But on the other hand, the environmental community is saying more jobs, people doing installing and the like.
Right. There's no real easy answer to the jobs question here. I think in general, if you talk to economists who have studied the general question of whether or not regulation or deregulation in the economy kills or creates jobs. Generally, what they find is it's about a wash. You know, that's cold comfort to say the worker at a coal plant in Ohio who has to go find a different job because the company that owns the plant has decided to shut it down because it'd be too expensive to comply with these regulations. You know, at the same time, there are jobs created when pollution controls are installed and when new plants are built. You know, that plant just might not be built in the same neighborhood that it was before. So I think you'll see claims on both sides, and those claims are probably exaggerated a bit on both sides based on the assumptions that each side is making to prove their point. And it's a hard thing to hash out, to figure out all the different parts of the economy that this affects, and to figure out exactly what the job impact is. So, you know, it's not an easy question, but again, I think generally you're going to see regional impacts on jobs, but not necessarily an economy-wide downturn as a direct result of this.
Well, we'll hear from both sides momentarily, but before I say goodbye to you, Ryan Tracy, what about the estimates as far as health and preventing heart attacks and preventing asthma attacks? I mean, EPA is talking about you know, thousands and thousands of deaths averted as a result of these.
Yeah, they are. You know, and those are real benefits. One of the big things that this rule does is that in order to capture a lot of these toxic metals that the EPA is regulating and wants to reduce, it has to the pollution controls that are installed capture these tiny particles called particulate matter that are emitted from these smokestacks. And by doing that, by taking a lot of those particles out of the air, what you do is reduce a big irritant to the heart and the lungs. And so by taking those particles out of the air, there's pretty clear evidence that you can reduce hospital visits, you can reduce the number of days that people miss at work, and the number of childhood asthma attacks and that sort of thing. The industry is frustrated a little bit by the way that EPA is estimating the benefits, because they feel that by focusing on the particles, which are not directly the subject of this rule, and claiming billions and billions and billions of dollars of benefits based on those particles, EPA is sort of being disingenuous and you know, taking credit for something that they're not explicitly regulating here. But, you know, EPA says rightly that these are real benefits, and there's some question, I think, as to how they're measuring them and whether, if as you continue to reduce these particles, you continue to get the same amount of benefits that you do, you know, when you're first installing these controls. But, you know, in general, the estimates look pretty good from EPA's perspective.
Ryan Tracy, Energy and Environmental Policy Reporter of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for joining us on Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Tracy is with us from the nation's capital. I should mention, by the way, that industry wanted a different number of BTUs, but the EPA figure, they say, is based on the Clean Air Act formula. Joining us for the rest of the hour, Michael Bruhn here in studio, Executive Director of Sierra Club. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Scott Siegel, who's with us from Washington. He's Executive Director of Electric Reliability Coordinating Council, the ERCC, which is a coalition of power generating companies. And welcome, Scott Siegel.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Michael Bruhn, let me begin with you, because Sierra Club is one of the litigants in this. This was a priority for the Sierra Club, jumping for joy. Huh?
Yeah, we are. This is best environmental news we've had all year, probably the best environmental news we've had under this administration. It's, as you said at the top of the show, it's the first time that the federal government is regulating the most toxic, the most poisonous emissions coming from coal and oil fired power plants. So this is something that will have a positive impact on our air and our water and our health for years and years to come.
You still have some problems with the Obama administration on the environmental front, but this puts a rosier picture on it, I'm sure. And I'm wondering to what extent at this point you're thinking there are going to be new jobs as a result of this.
Well, there definitely will be new jobs. And I think Ryan put it very well in that when you see a major safeguard like this that's being implemented, there are, to be fair, positive and negative impacts on employment. On the positive side, what this safeguard will do is force utilities to upgrade and clean up their coal-fired power plants. That means that new pollution controls will need to be manufactured and will need to be installed. The United States is a leader in producing those pollution controls, and of course, all of the installation jobs will be here in the U.S. Some plants will close down, which will result in more employment for clean energy. Now, to be fair, the workers who are working at coal-fired power plants, people who have been working in these plants sometimes for years or even for decades. When those plants are shut down, we need to find a way to take care of those workers. So the goal here is to make sure that that transition from dirty energy sources to clean energy sources happens in a thoughtful, a compassionate, and a responsible way, where over the course of several years, we're transitioning workers to make sure that as we clean up our facilities, as we invest in clean energy, we are making sure that people continue to be employed.
There are no coal-fired plants in California. How much is this going to affect healthier, fresher, cleaner air here in California?
It'll impact California in two ways, both of which are important. In the southern part of the state, in Los Angeles, for example, about 40% of the power comes from coal-fired power plants that are out of state, in Utah, in Nevada, and in Arizona. So the power that we'll be importing into the state will be cleaner, and this rule will also force an acceleration of investments in clean energy in the state. So it'll put more people in California to work producing clean energy. But then this rule will affect everybody in California in the sense that the air that we breathe, the water that we drink, and the fish that we eat, the tuna sandwiches that we eat, the sushi dinners that we enjoy won't have as much mercury poison in them. And the impacts on our bodies will be quite profound as time goes on.
Michael Brun here in studio again is executive director of the Sierra Club, and Scott Siegel is executive director of ERCC, the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council. Well, from your perspective, Scott Siegel, this can cost a lot of money, and it's ultimately going to come on to the consumer. But also, you think it'll make possibly electricity even less reliable?
Well, I think all of those are true. I think that from a perspective of macroeconomic impact, we're talking about a differential impact depending on what area of the country you're in. So, for example, in the industrial Midwest or in the Southeast, where we've had some of our most competitive new investments in manufacturing, those areas are going to be adversely impacted quite substantially. We think that in some areas that are particularly dependent on coal-fired power, we're looking at rate increases of as much as 19%, and that's substantial. How that's reflected in terms of jobs, very significant endpoint there as well. This rule essentially will affect jobs in three ways. It's going to reduce the folks that work at coal-fired power plants, which is obviously something that everyone's been talking about at this point. But also, if you go upstream from there, those in the coal extraction industry will also lose jobs. And if you go downstream, about 20 different manufacturing sectors are classifiable as energy-intensive and trade-exposed. That means they need affordable and reliable electric power because the products that they make are made in great quantities overseas, and therefore, if energy prices go up in the U.S., there is an incentive for those manufactured goods to go overseas. By the way, that's one of the issues California has to deal with. It's a major manufacturing state. Some of the inputs that go into California recycling come from energy-intensive industries elsewhere in the United States, and the price of those will go up, thus occasioning jobs to go overseas. In terms of electric reliability, there's been a lot of discussion, of course, about that. Even the Environmental Protection Agency admits that they're likely to see what the EPA calls localized reliability problems, which they believe they can address through flexibility they've built into the new rule. They could be wrong, and in fact, the staff at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which knows a fair amount about electric reliability, has observed that as much as 8% of U.S. Electricity will be retired as a result of the rule. That's like taking three states offline. And that's a substantial amount of electricity. Sometimes folks on the other side will say, well, but there's plenty of extra electricity at the margin. But the problem is we live in an interrelated grid where removing some electrical power in an area that may be electricity rich has an unanticipated consequence elsewhere on the grid in an area that may have a lot tighter margin but may not be affected by the rule, may be affected, for example, because they have a lot of nuclear power or gas capacity. So just because it looks like the reserve margins look good, that's only one element of the question of whether or not we have reliable power. And this rule is extremely complicated. It's 1,000 pages in length. By EPA's own admission, it's one of the most expensive rules they've ever promulgated. And so there will be impacts on electric power.
And what about health? I mean, I think you've been skeptical about incremental health benefits, and yet we've got certainly mercury is a neurotoxin that we know is harmful to children and pregnant women, and there haven't been any federal standards for its release into the air for power plants. And this is a first, as we've said.
I want to be clear. The electric power sector has spent hundreds of billions of dollars on air pollution control devices, and that's true whether your fleet is primarily coal-fired power or whether it's not. In fact, these coal-fired facilities are not unregulated. They each have federal air permits, and they're each also regulated by their states and localities to levels which the EPA has described as protective of human health and the environment. So there is a significant amount of regulation from the get-go. That's reflected in the fact that between 1980 and the current day, we've had about a 70% decrease in all of the major pollutants, including a 40% decrease in mercury levels. So it's not as though there's a crisis here which is unaddressed. In fact, what is really happening is a substantial amount of investment, an improvement in energy efficiency, and a reduction in all the principal air emissions. Now, that said, no one doubts the fact that mercury is a neurotoxin. It absolutely is. The question is whether this rule produces tangible benefits in that area. What the supporters of this rule tend to do is aggregate the mercury numbers and make it sound as though it makes a substantial contribution. But let me just put something in perspective here. The rule costs about $10 billion. Of those $10 billion the $10 billion investment, the EPA admits that the amount of benefit to be achieved by reducing the amount of mercury that would be achieved by this rule can be as low as $500,000 on a $10 billion investment. So where do the benefits that we've heard the EPA administrator and Michael and others talk about, where do they come from? They really come from what are called co-benefits related to the reduction of soot, which Ryan Tracy referred to also as particulate matter, accurately so, as particulate matter. Our argument is that other parts of the Clean Air Act that are purposefully targeted and designed to reduce particulate matter are doing so to levels fully protective of human health and the environment, including for susceptible populations like children, the elderly, and asthmatics. The EPA is claiming additional benefit as if it was linear to the single grain of particulate matter, which no scientist says that it is.
We may get into this scientific argument, yep. But let me get back with you just for a moment from the macroeconomic that you started out in your response with. I mean, just reading an article, in fact, by Paul Krugman in the New York Times, and he was saying that with ozone regulation and acid rain regulation, we were told that we were going to have the economy crippled, and obviously that didn't happen. I mean, flares are being put up from both sides, and certainly industry is suggesting that this is going to cause the effect on the grid and a kind of collapse that will really affect the economy in ways perhaps that are far exceeding what might indeed be the case.
Well, just from my perspective, I read Krugman's material this morning as well, and I have a lot of doubts about some of the representations he's made. First of all, his history is quite revisionary with respect to the acid rain program, which was a use of a cap-and-trade program that is not present in the current rule. With respect to ozone, he's simply incorrect about the data. Data that does not come from industry. University of Chicago had a study out which showed that those areas that fell into ozone non-attainment had a much lower growth rate than those areas which stayed in ozone attainment, showing that when the additional suite of regulations is applicable to a particular area, it tends to reduce economic growth. And that's just the facts on the record. He may wish to dismiss it, but those are the facts.
All right, hold that thought for a moment because I want to give out the phone number and invite listeners to join us. I want to, of course, hear more from Michael Bruin, and we'll hear more from Scott Siegel as well. But in the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. If you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, if you have a question or comment, we certainly would like to hear from you, and you can do that now. That is, call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Like to hear from you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, so feel free to join the program. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page and let us know what your thoughts are or any questions or comments you might have in that way. And, Michael Bruin, back to you on this. Particulate matter is being controlled is what I'm hearing pretty much from Scott Siegel. And this is a cost that really will put the industry into serious kind of situation where they're going to have to, again, jack up the prices for us who are using electricity and probably hurt electricity.
You know, I'm surprised that we're actually arguing about this rule. It's a rule that not only will reduce by 90% the amount of mercury in the environment, which is a potent neurotoxin, which means it's a brain poison. It causes severe reproductive disorders, developmental disorders, lowered IQ scores. This rule will reduce it by 90%. It will also reduce the amount of arsenic, dioxins, acid gases in the atmosphere. For every dollar of cost, we're getting at least $9 in benefits, and that's only measuring the amount of benefits coming from the reduced soot that Scott was just talking about. So this is a rule that will have a profound impact, not just on the toxics in the air and water that we breathe, but also in the amount of greenhouse gas reductions we're seeing coming from the power sector. And at the same time, it will stimulate investments in clean energy, all the while bringing more health benefits, far more health benefits than the cost that we're getting. This is something that if you have a loved one who's suffering from cancer, or if you've lost someone because of serious diseases, this is something that we should all be celebrating. It's an early Christmas gift. And I know that there are coal-burning utilities who will have to make investments that they've been resisting for years. But this is something that I think we can all celebrate.
And we go back to you, Scott Siegel. The celebration is, from your perspective, perhaps inflated and overly celebrated in light of the fact that of the cost and perhaps the health benefits not being as profound as we're hearing from Michael Brune.
Right. There's been some recent scholarship on this that I think is a lot closer to the issues at hand than maybe Paul Krugman is. And I'd recommend Susan Dudley, who's the head of the Regulatory Studies Program at George Washington University. She wrote a recent editorial, which is easily available, which really tries to unmask the EPA benefits analysis and compare it to the cost analysis. Her bottom line conclusion: tremendous additional cost associated with the rule, virtually no incremental health benefits, and in fact, the rule is so costly in particular areas that the resultant unemployment or the resultant increases in the electric rates may actually have profound public health impacts contrary to the protection of American public health.
But if you're reducing neurotoxins by over 90%, how can that not have health benefits?
Well, no one is suggesting that reducing mercury is a bad idea or shouldn't be an objective. Would that it were that this rule was actually a mercury rule, but it's not. This rule focuses well beyond mercury and draws in other materials for which there is no evidence in the administrative record of a benefit associated with public health protection.
Michael Brune, you had a point.
All right, let me inject a couple facts into this. What Scott is talking about is that the best data that the public health community has relating to coal plants relates to particulate matter. Particulate matter is otherwise known as soot. Coal-fired power plants are one of the largest sources of soot in the country. They belch huge amounts of this toxic. Think of an old Dickens novel, the amount of pollution coming from these coal plants.
Smokestacks.
Smokestacks, right. So what is happening right now is that the public health community has, as Scott acknowledges, excellent data about the health impacts of soot, the economic impacts of soot. They can focus this data on a particular state, on a particular county, on a particular plan.
We're coming up on a break, though. But what about Susan Dudley's work, which refutes? So,
I've read Susan's report, and I've looked at her analysis, and I understand what she's talking about. What isn't mentioned is the fact that coal utilities have fought the ability to get the same amount of data from mercury, from arsenic, from dioxins. They don't want the public health community to be able to evaluate what the impacts are of coal-fired power plants in total.
All right, we'll get a response from Scott Siegel when we return, and we'll also hear from you, our listeners. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Coal-burning power plants have 3 years to comply with the EPA's first-ever national standards for mercury emissions, and actually they can appeal for an extra year. But according to EPA, the new regulations released on Wednesday, yesterday, will prevent 91% of mercury in coal from being released into the air. Utilities are unhappy with the new standards, and they're citing the high cost, about $11 billion by 2016, and a threat, as they see it, to job creation in the United States. We're debating the issue. We heard earlier from, at the top of the hour, Ryan Tracy, energy and environmental policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Michael Bruins here with us in studio, executive director of the Sierra Club, and with us by phone from Washington, Scott Siegel, executive director of the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council, a coalition of power-generating companies that are based in the nation's capital. And we're going to go to your calls and emails. First, I wanted to get Scott Siegel here to respond to what we heard from Michael Bruin, because we want equal time. And go ahead, Scott Siegel.
Sure. One of the notions Michael pointed out is that somehow the power industry has kept the EPA from collecting data. Not only is that counterintuitive, but it's also counterfactual. In fact, the EPA requested, and in that funny way EPA makes requests, which is at the point of with a legal requirement attached to it, that the power industry submit millions and millions of dollars worth of data in the run-up to this rule. But then the agency used such a truncated administrative process, and frankly, such a sloppy process, complete with statistical and methodological errors, they didn't even have time to review the data that was submitted. So it is the laziness of the agency in relying upon their benefits analysis for this soot or particulate matter that is already controlled for by other parts of the Clean Air Act that leads to the charge that the agency is, in fact, double-counting benefits under the Clean Air Act in the same way that Enron double-counted profit associated with various subsidiaries.
I should mention here that there were last-minute negotiations on these power plant administrators with the Obama administration, and again, they argued that it was an inability to meet the three-year deadline for compliance, but in many cases, you're going to just have these power plants shutting down.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, let's go to our callers. Let's find out what they have to say about this, and we'll go first to Paul in Vallejo. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. Just on the issue of cost, I, as a consumer, don't mind paying more. I don't mind the industry paying more, and I don't mind the cost being passed on to me. Somebody's got to pay to clean up the planet. Upstream and downstream that's been referred to, they're both polluted. So somebody's got to pay, and I'm willing to do that.
Okay. We thank you for that call. And how do you respond to that, Scott Siegel?
Well, you know, it's actually heartening to hear somebody call in and say that, and I think that's wonderful. The problem is that the caller probably doesn't speak for those living on extraordinarily tight fixed incomes, those living at or near the poverty level, the elderly, veterans, et cetera, who live under constrained circumstances, for which the electric bill may represent as much as 25% of their monthly household budget. You know, we've talked a lot in Washington these days about the payroll tax holiday. The president, in fact, said that he wanted folks to tell him what they would do with the extra $40 a month. Well, the problem is that when this rule is implemented, I know what they'll be doing with that extra $40 a month. They'll be paying it in their power bill. And that is of tremendous concern to individuals if the rule does not produce the benefits that are advertised. And remember, we claim that it does not.
And you say what to that, Michael Bruin?
I say that it's hard to put a price on thousands of deaths that are being prevented, and it's even harder to put a price on hundreds of thousands of hospital visits that will be prevented each year. We know that people, particularly low-income communities, communities of color, are already paying a huge price for our dependence on coal and other dirty forms of energy. This is a rule that was 20 years in the making. It was literally has been 20 years in development. It's long overdue. And what it will do is it will lower the health care costs that we pay in this country. It will increase investments in clean energy. And it will force the retirement of some of the oldest, some of the dirtiest, and some of the most deadly coal plants in the country. And that's great news.
And we go to more of your calls. John is next. John, you're on.
Yeah, the coal industry rep just makes my blood boil. He's talking about EPA being lazy when the coal industry and the power industry is lazy and not putting in reasonable environmental protections in order to overcharge consumers and at the expense of putting in the scrubbers in order to pay corporate executives exorbitant salaries and overcharge consumers. And if you look at California, since the 70s, our power use has been flat. Nobody else in the country has taken care, has done that yet to speak of. And we could easily take care of the 20% gap and the 8% gap he mentioned earlier just by instituting conservation, which would create more jobs that are greener jobs than anything in the coal power industry supply chain, and would clean up the air for people like my wife, who has asthma and allergies and suffers from the lack of these kinds of regulations to this point. My father helped create the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, and it's made a huge difference here in California. I wish the rest of the country was smart enough to adopt these kinds of things in as progressive a way as California has. If we did, we'd have absolutely no problem at all converting these dirty dinosaur power plants and the industry supply chain, the coal supply chain that goes with it, that's dangerous to workers at the cost of coal company executive salaries and all of that.
All right, John, I think you've made your point, and I thank you for it. In fact, dovetailing with that point is a listener named Michael, and we'll get your response, Scott Siegel, who says, Mr. Siegel may be correct about the jobs in coal, but he misleads about total jobs. Cleaner energy jobs outnumber carbon-based energy jobs by about 4 to 5 to 1 in the United States, and the number is growing. Coal mining is virtually no one's idea of a good job, although I would dispute that. Remember, we had Robert Kennedy Jr. on. He was saying that many people live through transgenerations of being very dedicated and committed to coal mining. But I think the caller's concern here is with the lack of response for years from the industry, Scott Siegel. I mean, the statistic I saw was 40% don't have or have made no progress or don't have any of the new technology.
Yeah. Well, let me break it down. Three essential points. First of all, I think the caller is mistaken when you refer to these facilities as uncontrolled, even with respect to the 40%, which was an EPA figure, because these facilities are all highly controlled. The question is, if you have and I'm going to use some technical terms here, but if you have an electrostatic precipitator, which is a state-of-the-art piece of air pollution control equipment, and if you have an advanced filtration system, is the next step also to put a baghouse? This is the ultimate belts and suspenders approach. And we're talking about an industry that has spent hundreds of billions of dollars on air pollution control and has the reductions in air emissions to show for it. EPA's own air trends report shows a 67% reduction of the 6 primary criteria air pollutants, a 40% reduction in mercury. The second point is the only employment data, which I think should be relevant to decision makers, is the question of the net impact on jobs. There are jobs that will be created, both for forms of generation that will replace coal-fired power should those facilities be retired, and also for air pollution control devices should they be installed. But if you actually do an analysis of this rule, what you find is the upstream and downstream manufacturing impacts of this rule end up eliminating near to 2 million jobs. When you net out the jobs that are created, you're left with about 1.44 million jobs lost by 2020.
Of course, those figures are much lower from the EPA, I'm sure.
Well, they are, but the reason is the EPA doesn't consider full upstream and downstream impacts. They would claim that, you know, they don't have the resources to do that kind of economic analysis. Well, you know, we have put the resources toward it, and this is what the data leads us. The last item that
Excuse me, are you going by the Exxon regulatory report or research report?
No. This is the data that we use is from an outfit called NERA, which is the National Economic Research Associates. It's a 40-year-old economic consulting shop, one of the most venerable in the world, in fact. And yes, we did ask them to look at this analysis and give them the resources in order to do it. But you know, they are a very, very independent organization, and this is where the data led them. The last item, and I just wanted to get to this notion that somehow, if everyone adopted California's demand side controls or energy conservation, you know, more demand side control, more energy conservation, yes, is a good idea, and I think it should be encouraged. But here's the rub of it: there are certain sectors of the country which have become manufacturing heartland, where the manufacturing industries in those areas, in about 20 different separate industrial sectors, are energy intensive and are trade exposed. Meaning, if you increase the energy costs associated with manufacturing of those goods, aluminum, glass, cement, etc., we will end up producing more of those materials overseas. The jobs will be exported, and the pollution will remain the same or get worse, because those are less efficient facilities overseas that are manufacturing those goods.
We'll hear from you on this, Michael Brun.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate Scott has a job to do, but the fact of the matter is that you're going to find a polluter or a polluter's representative wringing their hands over any public health safeguard. You know, years ago, we heard the automobile industry saying that catalytic converters was going to ruin the industry. Seatbelts were going to bankrupt the auto industry. We hear here in the Bay Area about from grocery store owners about how a requirement to use canvas bags will put grocery stores out of business. It's never true. What John talked about, how his blood was boiling listening to the conversation. My blood is boiling listening to this conversation. I want to put this in perspective, that it was in 1970 that the Clean Air Act was authorized. In 1977, we lost a key battle where dozens upon dozens upon dozens of old, dirty, polluting coal plants were grandfathered in. They were not held accountable under the first Clean Air Act. In 1990, the Clean Air Act was reauthorized. And again, we have dozens upon dozens upon dozens of coal plants that for years have escaped effective regulation to limit the amount of pollution. We have technology. 60% of the coal plants in the country right now are using the maximum available control technology. What that means is the best technology we have.
I think it's divided, isn't it? And I mean, some of them have some of that and some of them don't have the maximum.
Right. So 60% have the best technology to limit air toxics from polluting coal plants. 40% don't. All that this rule says is that we have the ability.
No, but forgive me. I think it's divided among the 60%.
The real number is closer to zero.
It's not closer to zero, Scott. Scott, what we're talking about here is the bag houses that you mentioned before, the dry sorbent injections that you mentioned before. 60% of the coal plants have the technology to reduce that pollution. We have the ability to limit some of the most toxic emissions from power plants in the country. All that this rule says is that if we can do it for 60% of the plants, we should do it for every single plant, and the public health benefits will be huge. The greenhouse gas implications will be huge, and the investment in clean energy will be massive. And that's
what
this country
needs. We'll
talk
about greenhouse gas. I'm looking at somebody named Holly who sent from her BlackBerry. Will the new EPA requirements have an impact on greenhouse gas emissions, end up reducing one or more climate-changing emissions for additional benefit? And you're saying yes based on the data and based well, Scott Siegel, you're saying no on that?
Well, let me just make two points. The first is with respect to the 60% that already have the technology that's been described. The reality is, and I think what you were getting at also, is that there are many technologies that are required to be in.
That is what I was getting at, yeah.
Yes, and some facilities have some of the technology and some have others of the technology, but frankly very few have all the technology calibrated to achieve the levels that are prescribed in the new EPA regulation. And that's the real figure. When Lisa Jackson says 60% have it, she may mean that 60% of the existing coal fleet has a baghouse or an ESP, but that's not the relevant figure. The relevant figure is how many have all of the technology calibrated to that level, because that is what the law requires when you set the maximum achievable control technology. The A stands for achievable. So, that's why it's such a massive change.
Let me get back to another question here from a listener named Mike.
I did want to add one point about global greenhouse gases, because the listener asked about that. There's nothing in this rule that requires reduction in global greenhouse gases. But I'd agree with Michael that there will be global greenhouse gas implications to the rule, precisely because it will end up causing a substantial number of coal-fired power plants to retire, which brings us right back to the employment discussion and brings us right back to the reliability discussion.
And brings us right to a question from a listener named Mike, who says, won't gas-fired plants now being built replace the retired coal plants, and won't modernization of the U.S. electric grid more than make up for the industry's projected shortfall?
Well, I promise I'll give a short answer to that. Some coal-fired power plants are going to retire because we've lived through a revolution in energy with the bringing of shale gas to market. Now, I might add that some of our friends in the environmental community aren't particularly thrilled with the advent of lower-cost shale-developed gas because of its reliance on a technique called hydraulic fracturing. And I guess I would say you can't have your cake and eat it too, say that the cost will be low of getting rid of coal-fired power.
That's a whole other program.
And exactly. But you know that program. and you know what guests would say on a program like that. So you know, there is difficulty there. The second point I'd make is this. Look, if market forces force some retirements in the coal sector, that's fine. What a rulemaking like the EPA rulemaking does is require massive retirements all at the same time on a very truncated four-year retirement schedule. Boom, all at once. Any data that people talk about, well, this plant retired for this reason or that reason, cannot possibly take into account the competition for capital, technology, and craft labor that would go into massively replacing everybody at once. That's what the EPA is doing, and that's why it's going to be extremely costly.
All right, I'm going to go to more calls. Just a comment from one of our listeners on our web says $11 billion over 4 years divided by 315 million Americans is 73 cents a month or 2 cents a day. I realize the math doesn't break down this simply when it comes to who pays for this, but this is a no-brainer, and we'll go to more of your calls now. And we go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and welcome Kathy. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. I live in an area where I want to say it's the American Lung Association has said that we have the second dirtiest air in the nation. You know, we have several coal-fired power plants in our area, and I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, I understand it's going to be a cost, but that cost will be passed down to the consumer. And, you know, they raise our prices anyway. So I think, you know, living in this area, I know several people who have developed asthma that they never might have had before. We have Action Air Days in the summertime continuously, which we never used to have before. So I think it's an important thing to do. Yes, you know, we're all on limited income. We're all on fixed income. But I think if we don't do something now, you know, we have big issues in our area here. So, you know, I'm all for doing the regulation and cleaning up our air.
All right. I thank you for that. And I'll go right to another caller. And that's you, Tom. You're on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michael. And thanks for taking my call. The PGE disaster, San Bruno, showed not only that there was a lack of accountability and public, you know, transparency of their records, but they just didn't have simple shutdown devices, and nobody knew where the few shutdown devices were on the gas line that exploded. I was wondering, can we have emergency shutdown devices on the remaining coal plants when the particulate matter gets too high, thorium or whatever other is being spewed out of the pipes and, you know, triggering cancers and possibly triggering asthma, which is, you know, thousands of people die every year, you know, from burning coal, much more than actually died, of course, in the San Bruno disaster, but it was just more in slow motion, so we didn't notice it this much. So I think public interest groups should have the power to shut down, pull a switch and shut down any coal fire plant or even a whole region, a whole grid that's causing dangerous air pollution. Especially for the kids, sound a little bit like Hillary Clinton, but I think it's the American thing to do. What do you guys think?
All right, well, that's what we're debating here, and thanks, Tom, for the question. Actually, a question for you kind of dovetails with that in a way from Carlos in Sacramento, Michael Bruin. He says, I worked on the development of equipment for testing mercury fish and the subsequent testing of fish around the globe for mercury concentration. Although we can likely all agree that reducing toxins in the air is a critical step, I believe it is very disingenuous to sell this as a benefit in reducing mercury in fish. Fish mercury levels are much more a correlation to the proximity of cinnabar. Furthermore, the prohibition of mercury amalgamation of gold in California more than 100 years ago continues to produce some of the highest levels of mercury in fish that we tested of some 300,000 tests. I simply think it's critical to clarify Michael Bruin's comments with the fact that this will take a significant amount of time before we see clean fish as a result of this rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm not sure the person's name, but they're certainly right that there are dozens of
Carlos,
thanks for your comment. There are dozens of sources of mercury pollution. Some of it is naturally occurring in the environment. Most of it is man-made. What we do know is that coal is responsible for about 70% of the man-made sources of mercury pollution, and that it will take years upon years upon years for that pollution to be reduced and then to work its way through the food system. So why not start now? Is our point. Second thing I wanted to bring up in relation to the comment from Tom, and it relates to a couple other questions about the greenhouse gas impacts of this and the overall transition that's happening in the grid. What we, and even Scott earlier talked about how the impacts, I wrote in my notes here his quote, that the impacts, there will be huge impacts on the electric power sector. That's the point. That's the whole point of this rule, is to accelerate the retirement of old, dirty, inefficient coal plants and invest in clean energy. What we hope is that over the next several years, we can secure the retirement of up to a third of the power plants in this country. And then those plants will be phased out from between now and 2020 in an orderly, in a thoughtful, and a methodical way to make sure that as coal plants are coming offline, more wind, more solar, more geothermal, and a lot more efficiency is taking up the mix. We know that that'll have a positive impact on employment, and the greenhouse gas benefits will be immense.
And here's a listener from Dublin, Greg, who, well, focusing on China, where there's a lot of these smokestacks, a lot of coal-burning plants. Go ahead, Greg. You're on.
Hey, I think it's a great initiative that you guys are proposing, but, I mean, here in the Bay Area, we get a lot of polluted air that I'm starting to hear comes from the coal-fired plants in China. So this is a global issue. It's not just a North American U.S. issue. I'm curious what's being done on a global basis to promote this.
That's an important point. Michael Bruin, can you give us any light on this?
Yeah, you know what China's doing right now, actually, is they are making their coal plants more efficient. And they are starting...
Are you doing scrubbers in?
They are. They're starting to install a whole series of pollution controls that is allowing them simultaneously to shut down coal plants and, unfortunately, to also build new coal plants. So the good news is that the coal plants that China's building today... they are, by comparison, much more efficient than they were 10 years ago, and in many cases more efficient than the typical coal plant built in the U.S. The bad news is that every time China builds a new coal plant, it's locking in that dirty technology for the next 40 to 50 years. And here on the West Coast, there is lots of disturbing data showing that we're breathing the pollution that's produced in all the way over in China.
Well, here are some listeners, some emails, actually, Scott Siegel, I'd like to have you react to. Brian writes, the coal power industry has been spending millions touting a clean coal future. What does this term clean coal mean if not coal power with the kind of significant reductions in toxins as mandated by these new rules? Is the industry's promotion of clean coal just a snow job?
Well, here's the question is a good one. Clean coal refers to technologies which improve the efficiency and the emissions profile of burning coal. Here's the problem. The EPA has managed to set under this rule a standard which is so unachievable that it makes a lot of what were thought to be clean coal investments less economically viable and ironically will result in less of that technology coming to market in favor of simply shutting down power plants, which I think, as you heard Michael Bruin say, is their goal, a one-third reduction in the fleet. You know, I've got to tell you something. I don't think that's just Sierra Club's goal. I think he is correctly describing what motivates the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the adoption of this rule, as reflected in a statement that Lisa Jackson made not long ago on videotape, saying that she thought that the purpose behind the rule was to, quote, level the playing field between economic competitors. That may be fine as a social policy or as an instrumentality of centralized economic planning, but it is not available to the government under the Clean Air Act. That is not the purpose of the Clean Air Act. So a lot of decisions, we believe, were made that went into this rule that were made to vindicate a lot of the policy discussions that Michael has described, but they are simply not aspects of the U.S. Clean Air Act and would require, in our judgment, much broader buy-in by particularly those Midwestern and Southeastern consumers that will be tremendously adversely affected.
I'm getting a lot of emails, like a couple that I'll just read for you, Scott Siegel. And this is from Frank, for example, who says, this issue seems like a no-brainer to me. Same old story. Surprise, a paid representative, Scott Siegel, from the power industry, argues the case that reducing pollutants to protect health is fraught with cost, jobs, and supply problems. When will energy representatives take the approach that it is time to transition to clean industry, adopt a proactive strategy, and drop the defensive, worn-out, toxic arguments? And Robert says, it never ceases to amaze me how blithely industry justifies poisoning us to maximize their profits and how they are willing to pass the cost of their spewing their waste into our environment for us to pay for. I mean, you know, these are strong sentiments, but what's coming in here?
Right. No, I hear what people are saying on this, and what I'd like to get them to understand is that this is not an industry which has sat back and rested on its laurels, comfortable with providing affordable and reliable power and meeting the minimum in terms of environmental compliance. It's not what's going on here. In fact, the whole name of a coal-fired utility is a bit of a misnomer. The major corporations that are involved in that have as part of their fleet coal-fired utilities also typically have invested in natural gas-fired utilities, have invested in nuclear, have invested in renewables such as solar arrays and providing through billing programs the ability for folks to charge back photovoltaic installation and have at least licensed, if not developed directly, wind farms. So this is not a situation where someone is looking at the grid and saying, drawing a circle around coal and saying, that's all I want to do. No, in fact, the major utilities invest in a very broad range. But the question is, what reductions at what cost? And are we doing things to achieve this leveling effect among alternatives that, in a way that has nothing to do with the Clean Air Act? Are we misusing the statute, essentially, to achieve broader policy objectives? Folks that are listening to the show may be comfortable with that, but forget as an energy representative, as a lawyer, and as somebody who's worked in Washington for many years, I'm not comfortable with the use of statutes to achieve those broader objectives unless it's been authorized by we the people.
Well, final word from you, Michael Bruhn, as we come up to the end of this program.
Scott, I'll debate the Clean Air Act with you any day. The last thing I want to say is that what's happening here is that the coal plants are cash cows. These are plants that were built 40, 50, 60 years ago. They're fully paid for. And the owners of these utilities, many of whom pay Scott's bills, don't want to invest in clean technology. They don't want to invest in the technology to clean up these plants. When they're forced to, when coal plants are forced to clean up, coal cannot compete. Coal cannot compete with clean energy when they're forced to account for the cost of their pollution. That's why you're seeing such a desperate, long-term, well-financed campaign of resistance from these utilities. Because
I wish we had more time to talk about the transition to clean energy and sort of spell that out, but that may be another program in the future. Thank you all for being with us. Thank you, Michael Bruhn from the Sierra Club, Executive Director. Thank you, Scott Siegel, Executive Director of the Electric Reliability Coordinating Council. And thanks to Ryan Tracy, who joined us at the top of the hour, Energy Environmental Policy Reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And thanks, many thanks being put out to you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you. Also, our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our interns are Dominic Tan, Don Clyde, Molly Williams, Jameson Katsoufis, and Preeti Shakir. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.